It's 1 o'clock.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand Demel with you with The Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And you lead a more positively minded life by learning. Learning about yourself, learning about other people, learning about the people you're with. And we're talking about today, I want to talk about extramarital relationships, but not the kind you think. The other kind. The kind where a person has a relationship with something that's not another person, but it is a bigger competitor than any other person could ever be. I want to talk today about addictions. And in the studio with me, addiction specialist and good friend, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, who works a great deal with, that was part of the primary part of your work, right, Kent?
Absolutely.
Oops, I don't hear you. There you are.
Sure. A big part of my background was working at Smithers Alcohol Treatment Center.
Three major drugs are controllable. There are three. You say we have, people can have many different kind of addictions. You know, let's talk about some of the latest stuff we've seen on addictions. What about that study about the firm hand?
Well, we just, in yesterday's New York Times, there was an article about the importance of external control or other people being involved in the addict's addiction, and how sometimes it's very important for people to have other people monitoring and keeping the addict honest. And so even though there's a feeling, and maybe a feel-good feeling, that you really, the addict needs to want to change and come through some enlightened experience and through 12-step programs, some spiritual enlightenment in terms of overcoming their addiction, finding God, finding a higher purpose, this doesn't say that that's not true, but with that sometimes can be outside the addict, there could be people that will keep the addict honest, since the addict sometimes will lie to themselves and others about the truthfulness of their addiction.
Well, I think we better start by defining addiction, because people may probably be thinking heroin and stuff like that. Let's talk about what defines an addiction, what makes for an addiction.
I think an addiction is really a relationship to a substance or an activity which causes problems in people's lives. It's something that tends to get out of control and gets in the way of people's purposes to have relationships, work relationships, friendships, and the like. So an addiction would be defined as any relationship with a person, substance, or an activity that gets in the way of people's goals and plans. It usually has the various characteristics that the person does more with the addiction than they plan on doing, and they're unable to control it. Once they start it, it becomes out of control.
Mark Griffith once defined it as, he said it has to have five key components to addiction. Number one is salience. The second one is mood modification. The third is toleration. The fourth is withdrawal. And the fifth is conflict and relapse. Now, for salience, he said, this occurs when the particular activity becomes the most important one of a person's life. So now let's think about a number of different things. Internet addiction is one of the ones that we've been paying attention to recently. Sex addiction, work addiction. I mean, these are, can you call them addictions? I mean, it's just silly, you know. Food addiction, can we call those? What do you mean? You mean you're...
Well, I think absolutely a lot of people, and how you started the show about people's extramarital affairs, the number of people out there who would say that their spouses or significant others' work is more important than they are, and they're feeling often competing for the time and attention, because a human being only has time and involvement as something that they can give their spouses, their children. And yes, work would be a perfect example of something that becomes overwhelming. A person can't put boundaries on work. They become tied up with it. They can't stop doing it, to the detriment of relationships, the relationships with their spouses, their friendships, as well as relationships with their children.
It's interesting, when a person has a work addiction, how they'll justify their work addiction, and they'll say, well, this thing is happening at work, the ceiling fell down, and I have to patch this up, and the Internal Revenue Service is coming in, and I don't know what to do about that, and I have to, so that the mate feels powerless in the face of this. You know, it's almost like telling your mate that your mother has cancer and you have to take care of her. So there's nothing. You render the person who is making excuses for their addiction, renders the partner, the primary partner, powerless to interfere, makes them feel guilty for interfering. And this will do with just about any addiction. You know, it's a how can I not take my of course I smoke a joint when I come home because I'm so tense from my work. And of course I take a sleeping pill because I'm so tense from my work. And of course I, you know, all the other things. So salience means that a particular activity becomes the most important one in a person's life. It dominates thinking. It leads to preoccupation, cognitive distortions, feelings that are like cravings. And in the case of, for example, in the case of internet users, they, even if they're not online, they'll be thinking about the next time they'll be online. And I think Britain has been doing a lot of work with internet addiction. There's been quite a few articles in England, Kent. Do you know about that?
Yeah, I think that there's been a feeling that the internet has become a source for people to become overwhelmed with their relationship with the computer and cyberspace, that again interferes with their goals, to their work goals and their relationship goals. And since those goals are interfered with, that's why it's considered an addiction, because the person is often unhappy with some of the consequences of their abnormal and obsessive relationship in this matter with the internet. You know, that all this time spent on and obsessing about is distracting them and taking them away from other aspects of their world that they would get a great deal of enjoyment and satisfaction.
This is Armand DeMille with The Positive Mind, with my guest Dr. Kent Robert Shaw co-hosting with me. We're talking about addictions in different ways. You know, it's a fascinating thing, when you have something like internet addiction, you have such a sedentary lifestyle. I mean, it truly, you become more and more sedentary. You're sitting in front of a computer. Life, I mean, your cells inside you are kind of like fading away. And your mate is watching you go through this, and it looks harmless, you know? Mood modification. This is the second component of an addiction, mood modification. This refers to the subjective experience that people report to as a consequence of engaging in a particular activity. For example, they can be an arousing buzz or a high when you're on the internet, or whether you're having any, or eating too much food, or it's alcohol. Or paradoxically, they could experience a tranquilizing effect. So it's either one. You either get buzzed or you get tranquil. And that's mood modification. You change your mood by engaging in your addiction. Gambling is one of those addictions, you know what I mean? I've seen people, I have been gambling, and I remember times when there were the two feelings about gambling, the losing feeling of feeling myself sinking because I was losing, and then the elation when I was winning. And I said, what a roller coaster this is. Now, I've never been addicted to any gambling or any substances, but I have felt, you know, I have felt this mood swing that people are so addicted to in the casinos, that shout, that scream, that the winner, you know, becoming one of them, and the other way, which is the losing, the depression, the sinking through the floor.
Yeah, I would think that in this related, that a lot of listeners may understand, is what I think is shopping addiction, meaning that again, some people who are running into serious financial troubles, credit card debt and the like, part of why they're in debt and part of the reasons they're having financial troubles is again, maybe they're bored, they're lonely, they're unhappy in their relationship. Something is perhaps going on. And yes, the idea of, oh, I'll get my credit card and I'll buy myself a new hat at Macy's, all of a sudden picks their mood up. So shopping would be something like gambling of a non-substance related, but an activity that is mood altering. It lifts people's moods and the like. But yes, as you're saying with gambling, people come home and they look at their credit card bills and they don't have money for their rent or for their children's tuition and the like. And yes, there are often consequences to these addictions.
That and they get depressed, so they go out and buy a new hat.
Right.
Right? I'm feeling myself sinking as a consequence of what I'm doing. And it's almost like, I remember when I used to smoke cigarettes, I would every now and then, you know, many years ago, I would be smoking and someone would say, do you ever think of stopping smoking? And I'd say, yeah, I'm really considering giving up smoking. And without knowing it, I was lighting a cigarette as I was saying it. I was actually lighting up as I was talking about it. It's almost like the addiction has its own life. And if it hears you trying to interfere with your relationship with it, it grabs onto you in some unusual way. If you have a relationship with somebody who's addicted to something, they have a different mate. And you know, and it's like you're in it. No wonder you resent it. No wonder you can't stand the person who, you know, looks at pornography all the time and they do self-sex and then they, you know, come to bed and they're too tired for you. No wonder you resent that they don't have the time for you and the kids. Now, on the other hand, people who are poor at relationships, they love their addictions because that other thing that you have to do to relate to a person is such an enormous task. It's such a pain to have to talk to people about their feelings and what you need. Drugs, addictions, all easy.
Yeah, I think that that aspect has to do a lot with people's feelings of control, because the thing that's really wonderful for the addict is the computer, when I turn it on and I go to that internet porn site or I go to that internet gambling site or when I get that credit card or I go to that liquor store, you know, Johnny Walker is right there, right the way I like them to be all the time. Whereas if I call up a friend or give Armand a call, or what if he's in a bad mood or a little cranky or something, or, you know, or I'm in pain and I want to talk about something, but, you know, they're too busy or something like that. So the object or the activity often has an appeal for the addict because it really is quite under their control. But ironically, it becomes out of their control, you know, and then we're going to probably get to later about how sometimes other people have to come in and help with that self-control. But it is often very satisfactory for people that they get to control their mood states. Whereas if I just hang out with Armand, who knows, maybe there'll be a lull in the conversation, maybe we'll have things we'll stop talking about, maybe he'll say my tie is ugly or something, he'll hurt me in a way that Johnny Walker or a porn site wouldn't do.
Or a pack of cigarettes, you know, it's such a relationship. I would stare at people, and I remember looking at people enjoying smoking. And I said, you got such a relationship with that thing because that thing is a beautiful relationship. You want to feel a change. That's why cigarettes are so popular. In fact, cigarettes, you know, quadrupled in popularity when they became the automatically rolled, the ones that you could buy that were rolled. You know what I mean? If you had to roll your own cigarette, it was a big pain. But as soon as somebody invented the rolling machines that enabled you to buy Chesterfields, you know, prepackaged, well, then it was there in your pocket, and there she is. Mm-hmm. And if you're angry, light up a cigarette. And if you're nervous, you light up a cigarette. And if you want to feel relaxed, you light up a cigarette. And if any feeling you have that you don't like, you light up a cigarette, because it was so convenient and so easy. The paraphernalia that we all carried around, a lighter, and then in home we had lighter fluid, and then we had cigarettes, and then we had ashtrays. You think one day there's going to be a museum of ashtrays?
Yeah.
You know, buy ashtrays and turn them into some art form. I'm sure there was some really lavish ashtrays out there. Yeah. So cigarettes become easy just like everything else, you know? Now let's talk about alcohol. Who can make me feel the way a shot of Johnny Walker makes me feel? You know, who can make me feel that instant feeling of like sinking down and relaxing and my problems going away? Who could make me feel as good as snorting a line of cocaine? Who could make me feel as good as lighting a joint? Who could make me feel as good as shooting a line? You know, who can make me feel that way as fast as that without complications? And then they don't bother me, you know what I mean? Then they're not talking to me afterwards. Who can make me feel? Internet porn is just perfect for that, you know? Who can make me feel this good? I look at the internet, I masturbate, boom, it's over. I shut the computer. I don't have to talk to her afterwards.
Yeah, no cuddling required.
No cuddling required. It's just easy and it's out. So, the number of ingredients we have to a true addiction is, number one, salience. Number two, mood modification. Number three, tolerance. Now, this is important because you start off at a certain point, and you need more to keep you going.
Yeah, certainly that's very true, as people know, with the chemicals, without a doubt. But it's true with the other addictions as well. But yes, the same amount of alcohol or the same amount of cocaine or heroin that used to give a good feeling is no longer doing it. So one of the aspects of addictions where the addiction often grows and becomes out of control is the need to do more and more for the same effect. And that's usually related to the, at least in the chemical addictions we're talking about, to tolerance, that there's an increased amount.
You know, there are places, there are times you could look at yourself and you know that you're really there. Like drinking alone is one of those symptoms. You know, it's one of those signs that maybe you've become an alcoholic. If you're drinking on your own and you're getting, you know, drunk on your own and you're not doing it socially. If you're combing the rug for a little bit of cocaine that maybe you spilled on it and you're on your hands and knees, it's one of those signs. If you're a gambler, and you find that you're betting on every basketball game played in every high school all over the country with the belief that you have an edge. You know, well, what did you say about the Super Bowl?
Or just you know, unable to bet a little bit on the Super Bowl. You know, certainly a lot of gamblers, that would be enough to get them to start their addiction all over again. They can't do that.
And so you get to a point where you're betting a lot of money. Mm-hmm. You know, and I guess even the lottery is an addiction.
Oh yeah, I've had patients that are spending so much money, and yes, every time they get the littlest nibble of a win, they're as high as a kite, and then they're doubling up on the number of lottery tickets that they're buying the next day.
And here we have a state-sponsored addiction.
Oh yeah.
You know, just like OTB. So tolerance, more and more, and you find yourself having to have an increased amount. Withdrawal symptoms are another sign of an addiction, that when you stop, you actually feel it. Physical effects that occur when the particular activity is discontinued or suddenly reduced or not available. You know, and you feel it. You start to feel it. I mean, with almost every addiction, if you go on vacation and you miss your computer, you know, that's an interesting sign. It's showing you a sign of an addiction.
Yeah, I think as we were talking about internet, I mean, I think a lot of my patients and those listening or parents of people listening who have children under 25, you know, if they're spending hours on MySpace or hours, you know, in chat rooms or hours on internet games, you know, you wonder about how the addiction and how the tolerance has increased slowly over time. So the first, you know, they could just spend a half hour, an hour. I have patients, you know, particularly the ones under 21, that are playing these video games for hours and hours, and they're just feeling completely unsatisfied if something interrupts, like, oh, grandma's in the hospital, and it's like, you know, they're very upset and angry because they're going through withdrawal because I only being the operative word, did this game for 3 hours today, and I need to play for 5.5 hours to really feel like I've gotten a lot out of the game and enjoying it. And all the time I'm with grandma, I'm thinking about this cyber world as opposed to being interconnected with people who love me and in relationships in the three-dimensional world.
So you've got a mate or you've got a child, and your child is is an addict, and you see the addiction, Kent, and then you see it, at what point do you and how do you interfere? How do you intervene? How do you say, hey, wait a minute, kitty, you know, you're no longer going out, and you're just sitting down there in the basement playing Tetris or whatever they play, and you're not going out at all. Or if you talk to your mate and you see your mate has a food addiction and they're just getting fatter and fatter, or you see somebody who's having a drink on their own, you come home and you find your wife has had half a bottle of wine already, or your wine bill, there are a lot of bottles when you throw out the garbage. At what point do you intervene? Now, there's the job that you have, Kent, because I know that by the time they get to you, there's a question of, do they want you to intervene? Does the addict want you to intervene? Or does the family want you to intervene? Could you talk to me about those factors?
Sure. I think that one of the problems I see that a lot of people have with the addict is that they go on and on going to the addict, trying to sort of do an intervention of sorts to break through the quote-unquote denial that the addict has. And the denial of the addict is that their relationship to work, their relationship to gambling, their relationship to cocaine, alcohol, or the internet is really not interfering with their happiness and life goals. In fact, the addict will say it's augmenting their life. It's making me happier. It's my friend. It's my lover. It's a positive aspect. So it's very hard to intervene at that level, to sort of convince a person that their relationship with the addicted substance or activity is harming them. I often feel the best way to intervene is to say, I think your relationship with your addiction is interfering with our relationship. And that, I think you're on much better ground as a starting point, because then you're not sort of again, taking the inventory or being critical, or, to be quite honest, coming to the attic as a kind of, I'm smarter than you and I can see your life better than you can see your life. Now, most people I know over 21 years old, as soon as you come on that frequency, their reaction is a self-preserving reaction of, how is it possible you know what's wrong with me more than I know what's wrong with me? So that pushes mega buttons, even though it may be absolutely true that people can see other people's faults and shortcomings much better than you can in the own mirror. That, even if it's true, it doesn't mean that anybody, including Robert Shaw, is receptive to anything like that. It's a human reaction as you're a grown-up to say, listen, you know, I can run my own life, and I know what's best for me. Stay away, Joe. So when you come on the frequency of, you know what, I think the fact that you're spending so much on the time on the computer, son, means that we don't get to play ball anymore. Or the wife saying to the husband, you know, the fact that you come home at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night means we don't get to snuggle anymore, and you don't get to spend time with the kids in the homework. So at least you're coming from I messages. The person saying, this is how your addiction affects us. And since it affects us, and hence me, I have a right to say something. I'm not coming on to this problem as a parent about what's best for you. I'm just talking about me and my feelings.
One of the things we did when we ran the cocaine consultation service many years ago is we noticed we were trying to find what is the one emotion that cocaine, and it was particularly crack, helps with. And it turned out that the people who were most attracted to crack were people who felt in some way responsible for their family's well-being. So very often a young boy would feel responsible for his mother or his brothers, and he was a likely candidate because one of the things that crack did was it takes away the sense of responsibility. Now, this is an important thing, because to try to influence someone who is addicted by using guilt and shame does exactly the opposite, because probably the very reason that they've got their addiction is because of guilt and shame in some level. So you can't use it as your intervention. You cannot go in there and say, you're neglecting your children. You're doing this. This is no good for you. Look at what you did to your mother. You know, that's not going to work. Even though it may be true, that's not going to work. But what you're saying, Kent, is go in there with your own personal needs. I miss you. Our relationship has gone down, but I don't have someone to snuggle with anymore. I am no longer feel like I have a husband. You come home so late at night. I know you're working so hard, but I miss you. And try even to leave out the kids' needs. Try to make it I need you here. I need my husband. From that point, maybe you could be heard. You know, of course, maybe your mate will say, well, then try smoking this. Maybe you'll feel better.
Yeah, I think it's ironic that a lot of spouses and boyfriends and girlfriends go towards, I want to help you help yourself and get to, you know, I know what's best for you. I'm really worried about what the alcohol is doing to your liver. I'm coming in that paternal, I'm smarter than you, which is going to, again, push buttons, as opposed to when you drink, you're mean to me. Mm-hmm. Then that's about me. And that gets somebody listening, particularly the next day when they're sobered up, you know. Or, you know, the day after you drink, you're real cranky. You don't like to go out for a run in the morning and whatever. You just like to lie around and suck on mimosas on Sunday. And I miss that we used to do more positive, fun things on Sunday now that you're drinking. So, again, it's about me and my expectation that you're going to be there available and in this relationship, hopefully as much as the person saying it says, I'm there for you. I mean, trust me, if there's something I'm doing that's interfering with our relationship, please tell me.
One of the more popular addictions nowadays that people don't recognize is exercising. You know, and people will exercise in such a frantic way, and then they come home and they're sweaty, and you just don't have a mate anymore. You have this sweat machine who walks home exhausted, and they're no longer with you. It's very hard to go in there and say to somebody, hey, listen, this may be good for you, but I don't get the benefits anymore.
Yeah, I think some of these things, now when you're talking about mood altering before, now some of the stuff we're talking about sounds a little odd, but yes, I have had people, maybe even past relationships, but that's another story. But I have people where cleaning, I swear, is an addiction in the sense that it's mood altering. Rather than stick in the emotions and the feelings and the complications of relationships and friendship, they start cleaning frenetically and the like. And again, it gives them a sense of control. It gives them a sense of stability. So some of these things work. Working out, exercise, cleaning. For many of you listening, you're like, well, these are very positive things in our society. And yes, to a certain degree, they are, obviously. But when they serve the purpose to take people away from being by themselves, sitting in their own feelings, having interpersonal relationships with other people, it is interfering with their happiness and their ability to find peace and serenity just quietly, you know, quiet meditation, a quiet moment with a loved one, as opposed to a frenetic push to like, oh, I got to go shopping now that I have a half hour, or I got to start cleaning something, or I got to go get a half hour workout in. You know, there's a kind of compulsiveness to that that seems like you're not happy in your own skin, and you're not happy just interacting in a quiet, friendly way with the people around you.
Many a mate has said, you know, I come home and I sit down and she starts cleaning frantically. But, like, how do you stop it? How do you stop it? I remember the one man whose wife used to go on, she used to go to workshops all the time. Every night she was out running to a workshop. She was a workshop addict. And one day he grabbed her by the shoulder, stopped her on the way out the door, and he said, stop. What you're looking for is here. And she said at that moment she fell in love with him for the first time. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about addictions, and we will be taking your calls to discuss this a little further. We're going to be talking about interventions, and we will be talking about the whole concept of harm reduction, which is a concept that says maybe if you do just a little bit, you can get by. We're going to talk about that when we get back from our break. Okay. This is Art Farmer. It ain't necessarily so. It's a very important theme when you're talking about addictions. Enjoy a piece of this. It's an old recording. Art Farmer with the Benny Golson Quintet. We suspect Tommy Flanagan on piano. Suspect J.D. Johnson on trombone. Suspect. Hey, listen, and we have Kent Robert Shaw with us in the studio, always having a little fun. Let's talk about this addiction stuff. We're talking about drug addiction, and we're talking about addiction to many different things. Shopping addiction, gambling addiction. Exercise addiction. Now, you may think we're just using the word addiction lightly, but we're not. It is an addiction because you don't have a choice. You have a number of things about it. It interferes with your relationships with other people. It modifies your mood. You have a growing tolerance. You have withdrawal symptoms if you try to remove yourself. And it creates conflicts with other people. Now, this is what an addiction is. So in this growing way, it could be a television addiction, and I know people who have got that. It just interferes. It could be a cleaning addiction. Now, let's say that somebody has a serious addiction, Kent, and serious meaning alcohol, drugs, more serious, I believe, than many others, because the drug begins to take over, and it could deplete your energy, and you could die. You know, in those really heavy-duty ones, how do you know when you could step in, and how do you know when you can't? Does the person ever really want to stop?
Yeah, I think when before the break, we were talking about coming in on a frequency of how you think the addiction affects a relationship, and maybe you can talk about, you know, how they may not be aware of their addiction affecting their own lives and their own dreams and their own medical health in a life. But I think then there becomes a point where the person has to agree that the addiction is in fact an addiction and a problem, and that's the initial step that's very, very important. And until you get to that step, you're all dead in the water, you know, unless the person has some growing insight and some growing understanding, a breakdown of denial meaning that there's an understanding perhaps of their unhappiness or their discomfort in life, but it's not related to the addiction. But once the addict breaks through the denial and somehow understands their relationship with the addictive substance or behavior is problematic, that's when help can begin.
So you're saying at some point, let's talk about this concept, the old concept of ego alien versus ego syntonic, that at some point it becomes ego alien. At some point, ego syntonic means that it feels good to the ego. It makes you feel good. In effect, it kind of goes along with who you are. So if you take a drug and you work extra hard and you come home and you have a drink and you kind of remove yourself from the family and then you go to sleep, it's kind of ego syntonic stuff. At some point, you find you wake in the middle of the night and you feel sick and you have to go run to the bathroom and throw up your guts and stuff like that. And you say, it starts becoming alien. You say, this is no good for me. I can't find it. At some point, you find that you've spent all your money. At some point, you find that you've missed your classes because you've been on the internet. At some point, you find that your wife is having an affair with somebody else because you didn't even notice she was anywhere around. At some point, your children start getting in trouble right and left. You know, all kinds of trouble, including with schools and police. At one point, you look and you say, oops, I may be caught in something, and it may be not good for me. So at the point where you feel it's not good for you, you go to somebody like Dr. Kent Robert Shore and you say, I've got this addiction and I want to stop it. And that's where you come in. Now there's two theories about how to stop drug addiction. One is you stop. And the other is called harm reduction theory. Kent, could you talk a little about it?
Well, harm reduction means that you first try to have the relationship with the chemical, and let's use the most common chemical, which is alcohol. So the person who's coming out of the denial of, you know what, I really drink much more than I really plan on drinking, and I have horrible hangovers, and yes, I say things when I drink, and yes, Monday mornings I'm calling into work too much, or yes, the doctor told me my liver is starting to get fatty and I've got enzymes. So there's an acceptance that the drinking has gotten too much, and there's a belief of like, okay, I want to get my drinking back under control. Which is very different than going to a 12-step program or a treatment program where the treatment is sobriety, is zero. So the difference between harm reduction is to sort of say, let's get your relationship back with this substance or activity to a more moderate, more balanced, a healthier kind of relationship. Because other addictions, which are very hard to treat, like sex, like work, like food, people do need to do them moderately and shop. So there are certain things where it's very difficult to treat because moderation is the only game in town. You can't be on a sobriety food program. You can't be on a sobriety work program. You have to learn to start doing it moderately. And so that's not surprising then that when it involves chemicals of addiction, that's the wish. And in our society, where 80% of the population drinks, and I would argue that if you're under 30 years old and you're out and not drinking, there's, believe it or not, even a little bit of a stigma of not drinking if you're out. It's uncool or people start wondering about you. The wish to try to moderate your drinking and get it under your control is a very appealing step and one that many people want to try first before going to the extreme of drinking zero, which is what George Bush and Robin Williams and 10 million people have to make that decision. But the moderation is not a bad idea as a first step.
Where do you find moderation doesn't work? You said there were a number of substances where...
Well, you know, I find that cocaine and nicotine and narcotics being pain medication and heroin. And my understanding is that human beings, like all the other animals on God's earth, like monkeys, cats, dogs, and primates, those three substances, not surprisingly, are the things that other animals, including us primates, have a very, very hard time doing moderately. Whereas other things that we mentioned, including alcohol, are things that other animals can do. But those three chemicals, if someone comes into my office over 30 years old who's done coke, heroin, which includes painkillers, or cigarettes, and I use cigarettes as an example because I think everyone out there intuitively realizes that this person who's smoking two packs a day, wants to have a cigarette every once in a while, is going to be ludicrous.
It's
just not
going to happen. It's going to be re-addicted, yes.
There's just no way, Jose. It's just not going to happen, even though that may be the wish of the cigarette smoker to just do it every once in a while. And there may be people he or she knows who can do it every once in a while. My aunt Tilda, you know, only has a cigarette, you know, three times a week and one cigarette, and why can't I do that? And the evidence is obviously if you're a one or two pack a day smoker, you cannot moderately smoke. It is zero or a nicotine monkey on your back.
You have an Aunt Tilda?
I don't have an Aunt Tilda.
But you think anybody who smokes probably has an Aunt Tilda?
I think most people who smoke once or twice a week probably have an Aunt Tilda. That's my guess.
So listen, okay, so moderation, moderate stuff, which is what they call harm reduction therapy, you say can work with alcohol, but I mean, wasn't it the queen of, what about?
The queen of denial, and we're not talking about
Elizabeth.
Yeah,
Taylor.
Elizabeth Taylor. Yes, our friend Audrey Kishlin years ago was the guru going around the country saying that people like her who are, you know, stigmatized by going to AA and treatment centers like where I used to work, Smithers, Hazleton, and the like, they're inappropriately telling all these people that they're alcoholics when, in fact, they can learn to drink moderately, just like she learned to drink moderately. And she started a whole movement saying that, you know, you can learn to drink moderately like me. And maybe that there's something negative about going to a place telling me I can't drink at all, when in fact that's not true. Audrey Kishlin then, later on, past her prime of, you know, going on talk shows and starting this self-help movement, got behind a wheel of a car and in a drunken state killed a man and the 12-year-old daughter. So Audrey Kishlin is now the poster child against the idea that at least Audrey Kishlin, and in my experience, many millions of people, they cannot drink moderately. The game plan for them has got to be and can only be zero sobriety. Her point, though, which I somewhat agree with, which is for some people, moderation has to be the first step. As I said before, they're not willing to go to zero. And I find with many people that say, you know what, I can cut down my drinking anytime I want. You know, I choose to drink 9-10 drinks every Friday, Saturday. It's a very nice way to say, all right, you know how you're going to find out whether it's true you can control your drinking? Because you say to yourself, you can control it anytime you want. Go ahead. Because you think it's so easy to drink less, but you're not ever trying to drink less. Just in your own mind, you think it's easy to drink less. So it is sometimes a very nice kind of test for people to say, all right, let's see if you can not drink every day, 7 days a week, which is not what most people in the world do. And let's see if when you do drink, you keep it to one or two, or at most three.
You know, you treat a lot of people who come in with different addictions. There are two different ways of treating the addictions, and now there are chemical ways that you're also a master of, and there are ways of, like, anabuse. Do you want to talk about how does that work?
Well, you know, when we're getting to the point where somebody then says, I'm an addict, and I want to stop totally, then we get to the New York Times article that we talked to before, where then a lot of times the person is now open to people around them to try to help with their goal of staying sober, and they're having a hard time. So just the idea, and as, again, I'll go back to cigarettes, just because I say, yeah, I'm an out-of-control smoker and I want to stop smoking, doesn't mean I can then snap my fingers and then stop smoking. It's a rough road from there, but at least you're in the ballpark. At least you're playing the game. You're not in the parking lot, you know, in denial. At least you're feeling uncomfortable. So once you've decided you want to stop, external people monitoring, urine monitoring, things like that are helpful. But then now there are two big medications that I'm a big fan of. One is antabuse for alcohol. It's very simple. If you take a pill of antabuse and you drink, you get sick. Very sick. And so for people who don't want to drink, it's a wonderful, wonderful medication that helps them with their internal control. For those of you out there who say this is anti-psychotherapy to get at the underlying conflicts that are under it, or it's anti-AA, you're both wrong. It is very in keeping with most people's thinking about AA, and it's certainly in keeping with most therapists I know, because the key is you need to be sober. And this may be a crutch, but what's wrong with a crutch if the end game is sobriety? Then yeah, people can do the psychological and spiritual growth from sobriety, but you can't do it if you're wet.
You know, well, it's kind of an interesting thing. If there were just such a pill with every addiction, you know what I mean? If there was a pill that made you sick when you overate, but we don't have that.
Yes, we do. Dr. Robert Shaw is a big fan of a medication called Zenical.
Zenical makes you
tummy a little crummy, because what it does is it affects the fats in the foods. So for people out there who are out of control with fats in their foods, this acts as a deterrent, because if you take Zenical, and my understanding is that actually Zenical is going to be over the counter in the next few months, which will be a mitzvah for lots of people, because you don't have to see me and get a prescription. But Zenical is a medication that if you're serious about staying away from euphoric fatty foods, which, you know, they're pretty bloody euphoric fatty foods, it acts as a deterrent, because if you eat too many fatty foods, the fats aren't absorbed and it goes through your GI tract very quickly and you get cramping and diarrhea and it's most unpleasant. And you think twice about having that second or fourth piece of pizza or ice cream.
So then what can we do for shopping addiction? You got a pill for that?
Yeah, tear up the credit card.
That's, you know, right.
You crush a pill into the credit card and you get the scissors out. For many people with shopping, my advice to them is rip up that credit card, because it's a simple thing. If you don't have money to buy something, don't buy it. It just sounds like something my Aunt Tilda, I just acknowledge I don't have an Aunt Tilda. Sounds like just common sense. But a lot of that credit card gives a lot of people an illusion that they have the money to buy something, that the reality, the truth of their finances are they don't have the money. So if you don't have a credit card, then you check the money in your pocket, and if you have enough money to buy it, you buy it. But if you don't have the money, that little piece of plastic doesn't give you a false sense of having money you don't have.
Kent, do the rehab institutes really work? I mean, in my study, it was a third, a third, a third. You know, it was the old one third, one third, one third. The people who would go to a rehab institute, one third got better, one third didn't get better, one third stayed the same. You know, do you find that it's really, if a person has an alcohol trouble, you know, problem, they go to some institute and they're going to be there for, you know, for 4 weeks, does it work? Do they come out better?
I think that those, you know, that experience sometimes is very helpful to get people through the quote-unquote denial. And we talked before about tolerance and withdrawal, and that's a very uncomfortable experience to go through the withdrawal. So, you know, even being locked up away from your addicted substance for 28 days, that in and of itself can sometimes take the physical pain, let alone the psychological pain of your big love, you know, the big love affair with whatever you're addicted to. So this, just that time away, I think, can be helpful. But I think, in fact, the numbers are starting to look even less than that, because the sad reality is day 29, when you walk out of one of these centers, do you really have the coping skills? And that's where you need to come to the DeMille Center or go to 12-step programs or get some kind of spiritual or psychological help, because it's very easy to talk the talk in a locked facility and say, oh, yeah, how much I want to stay away from all these horrible things in this nice, nurturing place where everyone's giving each other big hugs and high fives all day long. And then you walk into the streets of New York and there's a liquor store across the street and there's a, you know, Krispy Kreme donut right next to me and whatever. And that's the real world.
And so you've wind up falling off. And I've seen so often, you know, I've known people who sold drugs when they were orderlies working in the institutions, right? So they're there, and it's like, you know, if you're there to compensate, to kind of appease somebody, if you're going to Smithers and saying, well, all right, I'll go in because I'm an addict, you know, I'm a sex addict, and you caught me cheating on you, so I'm going to go for a sex addiction program, then you've got the same thing happening, you know, while you're in the program. It's just not going to be there. There has to be a motive to really feel, if you want to feel it, if you've got to make that move. And if you can't, then you need the kind of tough love, people controlling you in some way, watching over you, you know, checking your urine, checking everything on a regular basis. And that's tough. It's tough. It's tough to get it, and it's tough to live with somebody like that. It's tough to have your wife become your observer all the time.
Yeah, I think if you keep it very circumscribed into one area, then, because some people out there who go to Al-Anon will jump up and down and say, oh, any involvement with the spouse is getting involved with the addiction and they shouldn't do. And I don't agree with that. I would think that getting involved with the addict in terms of watching them take the antabuse, for example, would be, you know, 15 seconds. That's how much you're involved. You're just helping the alcoholic keep themselves honest. And so I would say the monitoring of the antabuse by the spouse is a very critical thing, because it goes without saying, if someone stops taking the antabuse, it doesn't work. If someone stops taking the Xenical, they can eat whatever they want. The third medication we didn't talk about, by the way, is naltrexone, which I use for opiates. Naltrexone, similarly, if you take naltrexone, you can't get high with narcotics and opiates, painkillers and the like. So very helpful for people who have those kind of addiction problems.
And if you have, and let's talk about just the 12-step programs, I've found that they're, by and large, the most successful way to go. You know, that the, especially for alcohol, if a person gets into Alcoholics Anonymous, it somehow does the magic. And I think part of the reason it does the magic is it provides an almost family setting to take away this private relationship you had with your own family, which was the drug. So they give you kind of that set. I mean, I'm sure you've seen it as a real positive somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's it provides, because when the person who's addicted to a substance has some kind of belief that there is no other way to deal with the uncomfortable feelings that life hands me other than Johnny Walker or shopping or going on the computer, the 12-step program provides a place where there is often within those rooms somebody or some group of people where people will feel at least some sense of connection, or just the act of going there gets people out of the bondage of self, so they're not so wrapped up about the pimple on their nose or the fact that I didn't make this last week.
Thank you very much. Kent Robert Shaw being with us He's going to be running off as usual. You want to contact Ken Robert? Sure, you can do it through my website. Just look at thepositivemind.com. You'll see his pretty face right up there. Thanks for being with us, Ken. Thanks for you all. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. ThePositiveMind.com. This is Armand Mills.